This week's episode is sponsored by KVH, the service which creates innovative connectivity solutions for customers on sea, land and air around the globe. KVH is a global leader in mobile connectivity, content and value-added services, with technology designed to enable a mobile world and keep mariners always connected. To find out more, visit www.kvh.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell and here joining me in the podcast studio for the first time in a while, the podcast studio, that's a grandiose term for the events covered, is Caroline White. Hi Caroline.
Hi Stu. You make me sound like I've been shirking.
No, never.
No.
Would I?
No.
So we've got a bit of news to cover this week from all over the place really, but on the travel front, there's probably been a bit less over the last week or so, though I did manage to escape to Venice with the Fretti Group last week for 24 hours. And that was in part to go and see the new Custom Line 38, which you know a bit about.
Yeah, so I actually visited her a couple of weeks before you did, just before our event in Venice, which was the World Super Yacht Awards. And yeah, she's a beautiful boat, as you well know, having seen herself. The impetus for the project was actually quite an interesting one in that there are new rules coming in about emissions in the Mediterranean, which obviously affects a lot of yachts. And that means that from 2025, a lot of boats are going to have to carry extra kit in their engine rooms. So new boats are going to need bigger engine rooms. Sorry, that's very dull. But to get through that, that means that a lot of boats are going to need to be redesigned. And the Custom Line 38, as a result of that, is going to replace the Custom Line 37. And it's a really cool design. I particularly liked the Citerio Veal interior, which has these beautiful curving shapes and quite a pared back, relaxed style interior with actually kind of raffia on the walls and limestone in the bathrooms rather than marble. So it was very relaxing and calm, not super glam, but very calm.
I like the limestone.
Yeah.
Would be my preference. Every day, yeah, over marble.
Totally.
It seems that, yeah, there's just an overabundance of marble in this industry. A bit more limestone.
Yeah, absolutely. Going to quote you on that at some point.
Yeah.
What did you think of her, Stu? So you saw her too?
Yeah, we had a good look through. They'll sell a ton of these boats. They're just very comfortable, cruisy, med boats, aren't they? Great for the Bahamas too. So they'll do very well. Lots of volume. The 38 meter package, just a well put together, well thought through, voluminous boat that will charter very, very well indeed. Talking about voluminous boats, we've got another visitor to the Thames, which is exciting, isn't it?
We've Absolutely.
Got the 64 meter Royal Hackvort Scout is back with us in London. So she was delivered in 2019. Her owners love being in town. The last time they were here, I managed to sneak aboard. I think it was last year, actually, last summer. I snuck aboard and met some of the rescue dogs.
So tell us the story. So they've got rescue dogs that they keep on the boat with them?
Yeah, they're on the boat. I think there's three. I think there's three dogs on the boat. And wow. One of the boat is named after one of the rescues.
Amazing.
It's a beautiful boat. H2 interior, kind of Jules Verne, spectacular finish. It's just it's a boat of constant delights, I think. No space is dull. There's always something to see. Curios kind of hidden in cupboards and behind wow. corners, and you know, little, you know, visual surprises everywhere you turn on that boat. It's very, very cool. But it's not the only boat named after a dog. There's a few others. King Benji, we've featured quite a lot recently.
Yeah.
Her owner Josh Golder named King Benji, the 47 meter from Dunya, after his rescue dog. But we thought the Scout's visit to the Thames inspired us to look back at the numbers to see whether superyacht traffic to the capital is increasing or decreasing. And the answer is it's not really doing either, which is exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, so the best data is completely flat.
Yeah. So back in those wistful pre-pandemic times in 2019, there were 20 superyachts visited London that calendar year. In 2020, that number understandably plummeted to 6. Then it picked up to 12 in 2021. There were 19 superyachts on the Thames in 2022, 17 in 2023. And so far this year, we have had 7 super yachts on the Thames. The biggest boat over the last 5 years to arrive in town was 110-meter Chaos. We've also had 109-meter Bravo Eugenia in London. And I have also heard whispers that the new Kismet, the new big 122-meter Lursen, will be making its London arrival at some point this year, which would eclipse everything we've seen so far. And I think it might be the biggest super yacht we will have ever seen on the Thames. Wow. I say that with the usual caveat that I need to check all my data mentions with Raphael, our guru for such things. But that will definitely be a traffic-stopping visit. The media will be all over that, as will social media, I imagine.
So, I mean, I love London, but why would you come to London in a super yacht? What's the attraction?
You can get a massive boat up the river and park it in the middle of one of the world's great capitals. I mean, that alone surely is a massive appeal. The Kismet's usually timed with the arrival of the American football team, the Jacksonville Jaguars. Bravo Eugenia, I think, also had an NFL link, because once a year, I think, a couple of NFL teams come over and play in town, and the team owners like to bring their boats up the river. We did expect, given importation rules and the fact that we are now Brexited, that there would be more super yachts visiting London being delivered in the UK and then re-imported back into Europe. Those numbers don't support that theory, but I wonder if we looked across the UK as a whole, because often you see quite big boats popping up in, you know, Falmouth or off the south coast, new boats delivered from Northern European shipyards. So maybe we'll have a look at the entire of the UK, because obviously it doesn't, just because your boat's being delivered in UK water doesn't mean it has to be in London.
No.
But if you are getting your brand new boat delivered outside of the EU, I think I'd quite like to bring it up the Thames.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if nothing else, it would make a spectacular photo shoot.
Well, the photos are always amazing. I remember when Moonsand, the 55-meter Lursen, which was a cover boat a few years ago, was on the Thames. The photos from that shoot were spectacular. And I was on it, actually. We cruised down the river a bit and went into West India Quay. As the lights were coming on over the city, it was spectacular. And you kind of think, I get it now. Yeah, I really understand why people do it. It is, in terms of Scout, it's not once in a lifetime, is it? It's once every year, because they'll be back in August as well. And so I'll try and sneak on board in August.
Always sneaking onto boats. Keep an eye out for him. He'll be climbing up the back of your boat.
You don't recognize a crew member.
Exactly.
July issue of Boat Internationals coming out next week. And there's a very big exclusive boat on the cover. And you know all about that one, Caroline. So why don't you tell us more?
Yeah, so that is 112-meter Renaissance, which is this fascinating two-generation Bannenberg project. So John Bannenberg, the legendary designer, first had conversations with this owner about 40 years ago. And he did a design, but it never left the drawing board. Then decades later, the owner, having chartered for many, many years and gaining loads of valuable experience, had picked up the conversation with Dickie Bannenberg, who is John's son and co-head of Bannenberg and Raoul Designs. So they have created this incredible boat, which is considerably bigger than the original. I think the original was, might be wrong about this, something like 40 meters. This is 112 meters. So kind of a different ball game. And the shipyard it was built at is Frere, which is the Spanish one. And I'm probably pronouncing that horribly. I don't know if you got
it. I think it's right.
Yeah. Frere. Okay, yeah. Great. No, that's pretty rare. And it's going to be what is the 29th biggest yacht by volume afloat now that it's been delivered.
And the space is on board. I've only seen the photos. I haven't been on board.
Yeah.
But soaring ceiling heights.
Yes, they've done some amazing stuff with that volume that they've got on board. They've combined these little cozy spaces that you can hide away in and read a book or have a quiet conversation with these amazing awe-inspiring spaces. So the main one to talk about is the kind of main saloon / dining saloon. And rather than creating an atrium where your attention is focused on the center of the boat, they have created a sort of drop down mezzanine level.
Right now, Caroline's all hand actions.
Yeah, it's difficult to explain this without hands.
If we were filming it, it would be useful.
Yeah. So basically, you imagine a double height space.
Yeah.
Got windows on both sides. And in the center of that double height space, you've got a mezzanine level that runs longitudinally, you know what I mean, along the boat, central to that space.
Yeah.
So that space, that mezzanine level, sort of divides this huge space into two zones. You've got a seating area on one side and you've got a dining area on the other. So it feels very open. You've got the windows on both sides, huge windows, and you've got the separation for the two spaces created by this mezzanine level, which is itself a lounge on the deck above. Does that make any sense?
I'm with you.
Okay.
Whether the listeners will be, I mean, don't know.
This is a good reason to buy the magazine.
Yeah, buy the magazine.
And look at the pictures, which explain it much better than I will. But yeah, incredible, incredible spaces. Actually, so Ballenberg and Rau tried to do this space on the 87-meter Lursen Advantage, but it didn't work because the spaces weren't quite big enough. But on this larger canvas, it really does work.
It just looks like a beast, doesn't
yeah.
it? Stacked.
Yeah.
Boat.
Yeah.
Ballenberg and Rau touches on the exterior too. They're, you know, little cuts into the superstructure. In terms of new exciting charter boats hitting the market, it doesn't get much bigger and better, really.
No. Well, she is on, as you say, she's for charter with Burgess if you have 3 million euros a week to spend.
A mere 3 million.
A mere 3 million.
That'd make her one of the most expensive publicly known, because lots of boats are for select charter that aren't publicly listed for charter, but I can't think of too many that are charging more than 3 million.
Yeah.
I wonder what Flying Fox is. I feel like Flying Fox is around 3 million as well. Again, caveat.
Yeah. Yeah, all facts in this podcast come with a big star.
But yeah, spectacular boat. We've got the feature. Caroline did an exemplary job securing that one, because these big boats, I think I've said it on the podcast before, it's not a case of them landing in our laps. There's probably 6 months of work that has gone into securing that story for the magazine. So it is an ongoing negotiation battle sometimes to get the boat. But we've done it. You've done it. And it's a brilliant cover boat for the July issue. And yeah, if you want to see some of those amazing spaces for yourself, don't miss it. Right. Should we have a little look at brokerage picks,
yes,
Caroline?
Please. So my brokerage pick of the week is the 73.2-meter Admiral Explorer Planet 9, which is listed for Fraser. And she's had a big price drop. This comes right after a 6-month, 5 million euro refit and the completion of her 5-year survey. So pretty good time to be buying her. She's now asking 79.5 million euros and she's lying in the south of France. This is the boat that was in the Christopher Nolan film Tenet.
I tried to watch that movie.
I mean, I did watch it, but I have no idea what happened.
No, that it just it irritated me.
Okay.
I was trying to follow it. I was a bit tired and I gave up. Okay. I thought, I can't be bothered.
Well, the yacht was really nice anyway. Yeah, so it's stars in that film. It's a Tim Hayward designed, very cool, rather military looking exterior. And it's got a commercial standard helipad for an 8-ton helicopter on the aft deck, 2 large beach clubs, one on the starboard side and one on the transom, both designed for use in both warm and cool climates. It's got guest accommodation for up to 16 and 8 cabins, including an owner's suite with massive windows and doors out to balconies, and another master suite on the main deck. So plenty of very exciting accommodation on that boat. And as I say, she's asking 79.5 million euros and she is available with Fraser.
And she, another very charter-friendly kind of boat, isn't she? With the original feature, I seem to remember, that was kind of the point. Multiple masters. There's no fighting over the best digs on board.
Yeah, there's also a VIP with a private area. So yeah, there's plenty of space for everyone to feel like they've got the right cabin for them.
She's not a typical Hayward boat, I would say. I mean, she's a very cool-looking boat. I remember when she came out, that kind of the big aft deck. She was quite novel at the time because not many people I seem to recall were building that kind of big aft deck kind of explorer thing. And following her, all the, you know, the Sea Explorer series, obviously from Diamond Yachting. So she was, you know, leading the charge on that, the big explorer front. And I think she's done some really cool stuff. And the artwork on board, I remember, was spectacular as well. Yeah, so 79.5 million euros with Fraser.
It sounds like you agree that that's the boat that people should buy.
Well, I've gone, no, it's absolutely not. Okay. I've also gone for an explorer, but a bit smaller and much less expensive. So I have gone for 46.5 meter converted fishing trawler Scintilla Maris, which is now on the market with Burgess asking 19.25 million euros. I was calling it Scintilla Maris.
Yeah, me too.
Which is wrong. I got on the boat saying, oh, Scintilla Maris. And the crew and the owner were calling it Scintilla Maris. So if the owner and the crew aren't getting it right, no, I mean, if they were, obviously, I was wrong.
Clearly still think you're right.
Yeah. So Scintilla Maris. Sounds unnatural, doesn't it? It feels like it should be Scintilla Maris. Yeah. But yeah, it is apparently Scintilla Maris. Mm. But it's really hard not to be seduced by the story of this boat, which was a labor of love for her owner, Eric Vonk. So he bought the boat in 2006 and converted it over 17 years. And for some context, back in 2006, Tony Blair was still the prime minister in the UK. It was pre the global financial crisis. Facebook was a mere 2 years old and George W. Bush was in the White House.
Oh, my God.
That's terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah, makes me feel very old.
Yeah, it makes me feel very old as well. So Eric bought the trawler simply because it was the best platform he could imagine for what he wanted to do with the boat. In his words, these fishing boats represent centuries of evolution in the development of seaworthiness, comfort, strength, safety, and hull efficiency. So why design and build a new hull? Sorry, I should have mentioned before I quoted him there that, yeah, so this was a North Sea fishing vessel that was built in the 80s that he found and then converted into a super yacht. And his thinking was simply, you know, why reinvent the wheel? This is a super capable boat that's done everything.
Mm.
Great machinery spaces, great volumes. I'll just air it out, get the fishy smell out, put a nice interior in it. And then I've got the perfect super yacht.
Easy.
So he took the boat back to the yard that built it, which is Darman Maaskant in the Netherlands, and did a total tear down and rebuild. And the interior that he installed with the help of Rypak is very Scandi chic, lots of storage. It's very, very comfortable. So it was in London as well, actually, a couple of months ago. And I had a look around it and was really impressed. The spaces are very cleverly arranged. There's lots of zones, basically. So it's not like with a 46.5 meter boat, you've basically got an upper saloon, a main saloon. There's lots of little areas where, you know, you can separate yourselves from guests if you want privacy. It's available to you. You can have quite a big charter party on board, and everyone, you won't ever feel on top of each other. The galley's huge. The bridge is epic. As you'd expect, it's got this amazing Starship Enterprise like bridge. You sit up on these helm chairs and you stare down at this bank of monitors. They're the biggest monitors I have ever seen in a bridge. And they just sit just below your eye line. So you look out the window line, obviously, and just below your eye line, these vast flat panel screens. It is awesome. And it's a great platform for exploration, obviously. There's a lot of boat below the water. So she's very steady and the volumes are fantastic. And she's just been really very well put together by a deeply passionate owner and a great builder design team. And it kind of made me wonder why more owners don't pick up these old commercial hulls for conversion. I mean, it happens a bit, but not perhaps at the levels you might expect given the efficiencies you gain by picking one up. So Eric bought the fishing boat for around 1 million euros. And obviously he went on to spend many times that But what you get for $1 million is 46 meters of incredibly capable seagoing hull with reliable machinery for not very much.
So from my memory of talking to people about this, it sort of depends how much you want to change.
Yeah.
So if, as you say, if you've got reliable machinery, then you're all good. And as you say, it's, you save a lot of money doing it that way. If you need to change the machinery, then it's probably not worth it. Somebody's probably going to tell me that's wrong, but
no, I think you're right. I mean, I think you've got to re-engine the whole thing and then completely overhaul the machinery spaces. I mean, that lot of hot work, it gets very, very expensive. But I mean, this boat was only built in the 80s, you know, with efficiency in mind, because, you know, you've got to spend weeks at sea in this thing and you can't spend fortunes on fuel. So if you've got a fairly recent commercial build that you can convert, I think it makes a lot of sense. And my instinct is that we'll see a lot more of this kind of super upcycling in the future. I like I said, I absolutely get the appeal. They don't look like classic white boats at all. I mean, they're almost anonymous on the seascape. I mean, if you want to look out from, you know, Club Saint-Consanque in Saint-Tropez and go, you know, that's my huge white super yacht on the horizon. If you're a bit more modest and think, you know, I don't want to be in the glare of the lens the whole time, you don't necessarily want to be known and want to be a bit more anonymous, then a boat like this makes a lot of sense.
You might also say that at the moment now it's a bit more fashionable to have a boat that looks like this.
Yeah.
So actually, if you were sitting there on the beach showing somebody your yacht, you might want to be pointing to the one that looked like an explorer or a commercial-ish vessel rather than the big yacht, because it looks a bit like you're an adventurer, or I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Person. I mean, the whole explorer mindset, I suppose, is very de rigueur in the superyacht industry. And actually, we're featuring Jester in the magazine very soon, and she's got a kind of similar story. She was converted a little while ago from a commercial Soviet vessel, which was, we think she was a spy ship, don't we?
I did not know that.
I think she was a Russian spy ship out in the... in the North Sea, and then she was converted eventually to a super yacht some time ago. But she just had another rebuild at Pendennis, and she looks fantastic. As for Scintilla Maris, why did it take 17 years? Well, Eric told me it turns out good old Dutch stubbornness plays a major role in the length of the project. I wanted to do it all myself. He was, yeah, as intimately involved in this conversion as any owner, I think, ever has been, hence why it took so long. So, yeah, that's my pick, Scintilla Maris. She is yours for 19.25 million euros. Eleonora Pitasso, who is amazing, one of the nicest people in the business, is the broker on that one, and she obviously works for Burgess. So if you want to know more, contact Eleonora.
Stuart's clearly getting a kickback for this one.
Yeah. Eleonora might buy me a beer.
Yeah.
And we've also got the story online as well. There's a brilliant feature that I think Sam Fortescue wrote for us about this project. So if you want to go for a deep dive into Scintilla Maris, you can read it there for yourself. So obviously that's a much better pick.
I mean, he sold it quite well. It's a bit annoying.
Planet Nine's amazing too. I'd have both. I'd have either.
Right, now, shall we whip through some news headlines?
Yep, let's do it. So the first story we're going to talk about today involves a reported potential acquisition of Marine Max by OneWater Marine. Obviously, Marine Max and OneWater Marine, both giant boat dealers, basically, mainly based in the US. And so Bloomberg reported this story, quoting individuals with knowledge of the matter. Talking about this potential buyout. So both these companies, as mentioned, are giants of the boat selling sector, admittedly mainly playing in the smaller boat market. But of course, Marine Max acquired both Fraser and Northrop & Johnson over the last few years, giving them a firm foothold in the superyacht market. So OneWater operates across 96 retail locations in the US, and is on a self-acknowledged aggressive expansion strategy. It reportedly has made a $40 a share all-cash offer for Marine Max, which would put the combined value of the merged companies at $2.5 billion. So OneWater released a statement addressing the rumors, And I think it's worth reading out the whole thing to see if you can read between the lines. One Water Marine said, "As a matter of policy, we do not comment on market rumours or speculation. One Water is a highly disciplined and seasoned acquirer within the fragmented boating industry. Since 2014, we have successfully executed more than 30 acquisitions that have contributed to increased shareholder value. This strong track record is anchored by our ability to meaningfully expand EBITDA of acquired companies through expeditious synergy realization."
Well done for saying that last
expeditious
line.
Expeditious synergy realization. The statement continued, "One Water has a strong balance sheet and will continue to prioritize judicious capital allocation and maintain appropriate levels of leverage while evaluating strategic opportunities, enabling us to ensure the short-term, medium-term, and long-term viability of our business. Management and the board of directors are extremely focused on preserving and enhancing shareholder value. They are squarely aligned with shareholders, given that insiders collectively hold a 17% interest in the company." So I know that was fairly long-winded, but that to me is a long way from a denial.
Yeah, I mean, it's a...
That's basically...
We're not commenting, but yeah. We're really, really good at buying companies.
Yeah. I think the key line for me, this strong track record is anchored by our meaningfully expanded EBITDA of acquired companies through expeditious synergy realization. Expeditious synergy realization certainly makes a lot of sense if you're going to buy another massive boat dealer. And interesting, I thought, was their use of the word fragmented. I actually couldn't agree more with them here. The yachting industry is massively fragmented, and smart money would be betting on continued consolidation of highly prized brands within the marketplace. That's what I'd be doing anyway if I was in One Water's position and had their kind of capital. And we'll put the link to that story. It's a great one by Gabby, our business editor, in the comments below. But that would be probably the biggest business news in the yachting sector for some years, the fact that these two enormous giants of selling boats, mainly based in the US,
and
become one.
So who would their competition be at that point?
There wouldn't be any. No, not really. Nothing on the same scale. Nothing remotely on the same scale. That would be just an absolute dominance. Reaching from the smallest boats, runabouts, pontoon boats, wakeboard boats, all the way up to the biggest super yachts, because by buying Marine Max, One Water would take on Fraser and Northrop & Johnson. That'd be a mega corp.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, big news. If it happens. So on to less businessy news. What have we got next, Caroline?
Well, on the back of recent news about Shamrock 5's successful relaunch after a comprehensive rebuild, comes news that another of the J-class is going in for some work. That is the 42.2-metre Hanuman, which has arrived at Holtermann's facility in Mappel in the Netherlands for an extensive refit. Work is expected to take 7 months, with the yard under strict instructions that the boat needs to be gleaming in time for the St. Bart's Bucket in 2025. I guess that means we won't see Hanuman racing in the J-class events during the America's Cup.
Yeah, she looks like she'll be in the shed during the America's Cup.
The yacht's last refit was in 2018, and this yard period is set to go one step further, with 500 pieces of deck hardware due to be removed and the stripping back of the deck to bare aluminium.
Yeah, it's a shame she won't be at the America's Cup, but
Will there be a lot of J-classes there?
Yeah, I think they're expecting a fleet of four or five, which would be fantastic. I mean, Shamrock 5's target was very specifically to be ready for the America's Cup. A Rainbow's being refitted as well for the America's Cup. So it'd be great to see as strong a fleet as possible, because it's been a little while since we've had more than kind of two or three J's racing against each other. During the Bermuda America's Cup, there was, I think, four or five. It'd be great to get back as bigger a fleet as possible during the event in Barcelona in October. Last but not least is an important build update. Over at CRN in Italy, 70-metre Project Thunderball has arrived in Ancona for the next stage of its construction. The 1,100 gross ton motor yacht was transported by sea and remains on schedule for launch in 2026. So Vrijpak are responsible for the elegant exterior of this yacht, and Nauta has styled, or will style, the interior. It's taken 2 years of designing, confirmed the owner, who spoke exclusively to Boat International last year about the project. So the finished boat will have a classic long bow, smooth sheer and low profile that Marnix, the co-creative director and partner at Vryprak, said is deliberately reminiscent of times past. It's definitely at once a backward and forwards looking boat because it's very efficient. Lots of CFD was done to maximize efficiency. But yeah, she's a bit of a timeless, classic looking boat.
I actually took the word timeless out of your notes, Stu, because I hate that word.
Do you?
It seems like this is the one instance in which it's true.
We've got a few band. What are the other band words that boats have? Sumptuous.
Got many.
Sumptuous is band.
Sleek.
Sleek. We use sleek quite a lot, though, I think. Sleek.
No, if I see it, it goes.
Do you delete sleek?
Yeah.
No, good work.
Yeah.
No sleek or sumptuous boats in Boat International. Yeah. Excellent. So when delivered, we expect to see Project Thunderball shuttling between the Med, Bahamas and Florida. She'll be used for spearfishing and diving and supporting a sailing program. The steel and aluminium yacht has a beam of 11 meters and a relatively shallow draft of 3.2 meters, allowing her to sail and anchor close to the shore, explained Marnix. He added, a rigorous CFD and tank testing program was conducted by us to support the development of the line's plan. Other features include a winter garden located in the central area of the sun deck and a lower deck swimming pool positioned near the beach club, which is designed and built with a cold bath system. So CRN is busy, obviously as part of the Fretti Group. CRN has three further full custom yachts in build. The 67-meter CRN Project Marinello, 85-meter CRN 144, and 67-meter CRN Project 146.
Wowza. Busy.
Yeah, busy shipyard. Fretti Group, we covered some results from theirs on the pod a few weeks ago. Yeah, they seem to be doing very, very well indeed. Certainly that was the impression I got after spending a bit of time with them last week in Venice. Yeah, they're very pleased with how things are going. And the fact that CRN is building ever bigger custom yachts and cool custom yachts like this is massive for that brand. Alrighty, from Italy to Southeast Asia. So we're going to talk through numbers coming out of that part of the world for our data section, which, as ever, is brought to you by Boat Pro, the super industry's leading and award-winning market intelligence service. So why are we talking about Southeast Asia, Caroline?
Well, the number of super yachts visiting the area is on an upward trend. According to Boat Pro, the number of super yachts in Southeast Asia has increased by 29% over the past 5 years, rising from 227 in 2019 to 293 in 2023. More than 62% of yachts in the Southeast Asia sit between 24 and 40 meters, whereas 70 meter plus yachts represent approximately 5.5% of the total fleet. So a fairly small fleet. That could suggest that first-time yacht owners are entering the industry at the smaller end, or the need for greater manoeuvrability when navigating Southeast Asia's shallow seas. So fueling the region's growing superyacht sector is its rapidly developing ultra-high net worth population. According to the 2024 wealth report from Knight Frank, Asia's ultra-high net worth population is set to grow faster than any other region in the world over the next 5 years. James Clayton, Director of Sales at Simpson Superyachts, said, "We strongly believe it'll be the fastest growing market in yachting too. There's a huge appeal for yacht ownership, particularly among the younger generations."
It's an interesting part of the world because obviously the cruising opportunities are spectacular and around, you know, Phuket and obviously cruising further into Indonesia and, you know, around Bali and, you know, up north and Rajarampat. I mean, it's a lifetime, many lifetimes of cruising opportunities out there. And, you know, you'd never get bored. 18,000 islands in Indonesia. I'm not sure how many in Thailand, but tons. So, it's a beautiful region, beautiful cruising, pain to get to. But, you know, the destination, I think, makes up for it. Services, I think, is probably where most people might be wary. You know, marina access, provisioning, fueling, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, there are hubs for ready access to those things. But what these numbers seem to suggest is it's the local market. getting much more into yachting. It's not a bunch of people from Europe sending their boats to Asia, Southeast Asia. It's wealthy people from the region getting into yachting, or even from further north in China, and accessing the water through Southeast Asia is my kind of read on it, especially because the bulk of the growth seems to be in the smaller end of the super yacht sector, between 24 and 40 meters. But, you know, those people will enter at 24 and upgrade and upgrade and upgrade. So, you know, if you are taking the long-term view, it's very promising for Southeast Asia and yacht ownership in that region. And I think, you know, more and more brands are investing in the area. So that makes total sense.
So we do have a very well-informed source who believes that it's a bit overblown, basically.
Oh, really?
Yes. So he reckons that there is growth, but it's smaller than the rest of the world still. And it's basically following a normal trend rather than being a boom. And he has, from conversations he's had with Taiwanese yards, they still see the Asian market as quite limited for them. And he also spoke to a Hong Kong yachting journalist who said that there's really no market in China, which is often touted as the next big thing. Although there is a bit of a boom in Hainan, which but that's for kind of charter day boats, which are quite small, between 45 and 60 foot max, and probably slightly lower quality. And people just rent them for the day. So it's not, if that's true, then it's not quite, you know, calling it a boom might be an exaggeration. But yeah, I think the issue he was pointing to is that the things that have limited the Asian market in the past remain, primarily that there's a cultural roadblock there, and that there isn't this sort of pre-existing culture of on-water leisure activity that we have in Europe or the US.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Well, I wonder if anyone disagrees with that well-informed source about the potential for yachting in Southeast Asia. But yeah. China's, I mean, a perennial question mark, and it has been for 20 years. I mean, every time someone says China's the next big thing, it never materializes. And there was a massive crackdown on ostentatious displays of wealth by Xi when he came to power. And that really put the kibosh on any kind of green shoots of yacht ownership. That there were a few sproutings, but it seems to me the moneyed classes in places like Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, etc., might be discovering yachting in greater numbers. Small numbers, admittedly, but you know, from tiny acorns to mighty oaks grow, Caroline. I guess we'll see. Yeah. And we'll keep you posted with the data. And I think that's it for this week. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you, Stu.
Great to be back in the studio with you.
You too.
AKA the events covered. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's episode of Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Naomi Wilson and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we will see you next time.